Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. This is Scott Reich of Crime Talk. Thanks for watching. First on the docket, Chad Daybell gets the transcript ordered by the court. Second, a case out of Rochester, New York. Is it awful but lawful, or just simply unlawful? Let me know. Second, a pregnant mom on her way to her sonogram goes missing. A case update. Third, a case out of Illinois. I'm not sure what to make of it. Is it foul play or something else? Our cold case of the day, and finally, our dumb criminal contestant of the day. Let's talk about it. Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. First, thanks for watching. We'd ask if you haven't done so already, please hit that subscribe button, hit that like button, and leave us a comment below about what we discuss. First on the docket, Chad Daybell. That's right, and Lori Vallow. Now, yesterday we talked about the motion for joinder that was filed by the prosecution. Well, the judge also signed another order. He gave an order granting Chad Daybell to have produced at his own expense the transcript for the preliminary hearing. Now, as you may recall, this preliminary hearing went on for a good 2 days, roughly 6 hours each day. And you can actually find a link below where you can watch the entire preliminary hearing and with some commentary thrown in by me as things go along. Now, a lot of people think that you just get these preliminary hearing transcripts or any transcripts for free. No, you don't. A court reporter has to prepare them. And you would think, well, how difficult could that be, right? They're taking notes up there with their shorthand that they use on their little stenography machine. Yeah, no. Most people don't realize this, but the court reporters usually get to hear that testimony about three times because they hear it in court, they're taking it down the best they can, and the really good ones do it in real time, and they try to make corrections as they go on the computer at that time. But then they have to go back and listen to it again, usually, or review their notes to make sure everything's correct. And they oftentimes have to proof it yet again. So they get to listen to that testimony 3-4 times before the final transcript goes out. Now, who pays for that? Well, if the client is court appointed, the state pays for that. In a private case, however, you can order the transcript, and you can rush an expedited transcript, which costs more money. But the average going rate, at least that I'm familiar with, is anywhere between $3 to $3.50 per page. So a two-day transcript of this hearing could cost roughly $3,500 to about $5,000. And of course, who's going to pay that? Chad Daybell. It's coming out of his trust account, or what is left of it after the attorneys go through it for billing for their time as well as expenses. And I guarantee you, Mr. Pryor is not going to pay for that transcript on his own, hoping to get paid. He's only going to do it if he's been paid the costs up front. Now, as we mentioned yesterday, the prosecution filed their motion for joinder. That is to have both cases of Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell heard at one time in one particular trial. Well, the motion was filed, and then today the brief in support of it is filed, and bam, just like I had stated it would, is that under the rules of criminal procedure, two or more defendants may be charged on the same complaint, indictment, or information if they are alleged to have participated in the same act or transactions or in the same set of acts or transactions constituting an offense or offenses. Now, here, the complaints were filed in separate cases. However, the court can join those indictments or informations if they have alleged to have participated in the same transaction. And obviously, that is the state of the evidence here, is that Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell participated in the same alleged transaction, which was criminal in nature. The district attorney goes on in their brief citing that joint trials are particularly appropriate when co-defendants are charged with a conspiracy. As we noted yesterday, obviously this is a conspiracy. The evidence is nearly identical, and to have a single joint trial would be efficient for the court. It's what they refer to as judicial economy. And frankly, it just makes sense not to have to do this twice unless there's some overall compelling reason for the court to do so. As we stated, normally it's because there's conflicting defenses, which means they would have to point at each other. But everything so far seems to point to the fact that they're running a general denial, which is, we didn't know the children were there. We have no idea. How could that have happened? We have no idea. That's what they're saying, general denial. And in this particular case, the prosecutor notes that Lori DeBell's case was assigned to a different judge than Chad DeBell's case, and assigning the defendant's case to two separate judges will create an undue burden on the state by requiring repetitive work and hearings. They also note that the victims and living relatives of the deceased minor children are also prejudiced if they have to attend and if they desire to attend all the hearings they have a right to attend pursuant to victims' rights statute. The prosecutor also notes that this is a high-profile case and the workload it will present to the court and the judges that preside over these cases could be overwhelming. However, judicial economy, efficiency, and consistency will be better served by consolidating these cases to one judge. We'll see what the response is when the defendants have to file their response, usually within 7 days, and we'll see if they make any of the same arguments that I anticipate that they will make. Ultimately, I think the court is going to grant this motion to join, and the case will be consolidated, and they'll set it for one trial. We'll see how things develop. Next on the docket, a troubling case out of New York. Now, people are going to have to decide whether this was lawful but awful, or was this just completely unlawful? And what we've learned is that a black man who was running naked through the streets of Western New York City died of asphyxiation after a group of police officers put a hood over his head, then pressed his face into the pavement for roughly 2 minutes. Now, this is according to the video that has been released by the man's family. Daniel Prude died March 30th after he was taken off life support, 7 days after the encounter with the Rochester Police Department. His death received no public attention until Wednesday when his family held a news conference and released the police body cam video and the written reports obtained through public records request. Mr. Prude's brother said that he placed a call to the police so that his brother could get help. Apparently, Mr. Prude was naked, running through the streets when the police made contact with him. And Mr. Prude is obviously making some statements, and he does not want to have the spit hood put on him. Now, it appears that the police officers put the spit hood on him because he was, in fact, spitting at the police officers. I'm sure the police officers believed that they were following procedure and doing what they thought was appropriate, not only to protect Mr. Prude and the police officers. You can also hear Mr. Prude stating, "They're trying to kill me," as his voice becomes muffled under the hood. The officers also become somewhat concerned after Mr. Prude stops moving. He falls silent, and they notice that water is coming out from his mouth. One of the officers asks, "Are you puking?" The officer notes that he's been out naked in the street for some time. Another remarks, he feels pretty cold. His head had been down for about 2 minutes on the video. The medical examiner concluded that Prude's death was a homicide caused by complications of asphyxia in the setting of physical restraint. The report also lists excited delirium and acute intoxication by PCP as a contributing factor. Now, the Rochester Police Department had actually taken Mr. Prude into custody for a mental health evaluation around 7 p.m. on March 22nd. This was about 8 hours before the encounter, which led to his ultimate death. His brother said that he was only at the hospital for a few hours. Now, Mr. Prude's death has been turned over to the state attorney general, Letitia James, and they're only beginning their investigation. And according to New York law, apparently, deaths of unarmed people in police custody are turned over to the attorney general's office rather than those being handled by local officials. Can't say I necessarily disagree with that procedure. So this is going to be a case where obviously you have a man with potential mental health issues, was on PCP running around naked, and the police put a spit hood on him while he's spitting at police officers. I'm sure some people are going to simply say that he died at the hands of the police, and others will say this is a completely lawful situation. In this particular case, none of the officers have been charged. No officers have been suspended or disciplined. So it would appear as though the officers, at least being treated by their superiors in this particular situation, acknowledge that this death is obviously tragic, but it is not the fault of the police officers. Let me know what you think about this case. An update on the Cassandra Cantrell disappearance. She is the woman from Washington State who disappeared on August 25th, and she was on her way to a sonogram. No one has heard from her since, and people are quite concerned. The Pierce County Sheriff's Department, along with the SWAT team, served a warrant at the home of Cantrell's ex-boyfriend the other night. And the ex-boyfriend stated that the authorities have a suspect in mind, but it is unclear if the boyfriend was in fact that suspect. Forensic crews combed the ex-husband's home and vehicle for looking for any clues as it related to Cantrell. Apparently, this ex dated Miss Cantrell years ago, but they're doing a thorough search to see if there's anything relevant to her disappearance that would lead them to this particular defendant. Now, understand, you don't just go and search somebody's house. You have to go get a warrant to do so. And so there has to be some evidence that the police believe link this ex-boyfriend to Miss Cantrell's disappearance. It can't just be, well, he dated her one time and we'd like to go take a look around. That isn't enough. Of course, the police aren't telling us what they have to obtain that search warrant and ultimately search the car and the home. Now, Miss Cantrell is a white woman. She stands 5'7" tall. She weighs about 180 pounds and has brown hair and blue eyes. If anyone has seen her, please contact 911. Before we go on with the docket, a quick recess. Ladies and gentlemen, and a lot of you have done this, I'm so impressed. Please go to crimetalksearch.com and sign up for a background subscription service. This is probably one of the best investments that you will ever make. Yes, there is a fee, but guess what? With that fee, you can search as many people as you want, and the beautiful thing is that you can do it anonymously. Now, you can cancel it anytime you would like, but when you conduct a search, literally within seconds to minutes from the time that you hit search that particular individual, you get a report generated by this search engine reviewing millions of public records throughout the country, and you will get information related to the person that you search, anything related to social media contacts that they have, anything regarding emails that they have, anything regarding phone numbers associated with these particular individuals, which if you think maybe it's weird that he doesn't answer that phone all the time, maybe it's a burner phone that he's given you. In today's world, you want to know with whom you are dealing. And that report will give you all that information, plus criminal background records, property records, marital records, i.e. divorce records, bankruptcies, and civil judgments. These are all the types of things that you want to know about people that you're getting involved with, whether it's through business or through romantic interaction. You want to be sure that the person is whom they are dealing with. Please go to crimetalksearch.com, sign up. You'll be happy that you did. We use this in our law firm every day. We search people all the time. If they show up on a witness list, we want to look at their social media. This is where we turn first. Now you can do it too. Go to crimetalksearch.com. You'll be happy you did. Next on the docket, here's a case of a missing high-ranking United Airlines executive out of Illinois. His name is Jake Cefolia. And what's odd is that Mr. Cefolia disappeared around August 8th, the same day his Range Rover was found abandoned in a parking lot adjacent to the Waterfall Glen Forest Preserve in Lamont, Illinois. An investigation has revealed that Mr. Cefolia was spotted at a Shell gas station on Butterfield Road in Elmhurst shortly after 9:15 on the morning of August 7th. He's in his Range Rover but it's unclear exactly what clothing he was actually wearing. What I can't make about this particular situation is that Mr. Sefolia was the subject of a criminal investigation that began before he was reported missing. Now, he wasn't charged of any crimes, and we're not trying to say that he was, but he was under investigation, and no warrant had ever been issued for his arrest. And the city of Elmhurst declined to provide any information related to this ongoing criminal investigation. That is probably the most interesting fact of this particular case. A high-ranking corporate executive usually just doesn't abandon his car and not show up. The police have searched the area where his car was found. He's been known to go on jogs and exercise around this area. Apparently, he was rather fit, but there's been no finding of him yet to date. He also flew right before this to California and on August 4th and returned on August 5th. Apparently, he had recently broken up with a girlfriend out there. None of his family, friends, or colleagues at work who've been interviewed by the police have had any contact with Sefolia since August 6th. And obviously, here we are now in early September. So if anyone has any information regarding Mr. Sefolia, they should call the Elmhurst Police Department at 630-530-3050. All right, next on the docket, our cold case of the day. And our cold case of the day is basically what they refer to as the Sumpner County Does, Jock Doe and Jane Doe. They were two unidentified homicide victims found in Sumpner County, South Carolina. Now, this goes back to August of 1976. Each victim had been shot three times, receiving one shot in the throat, one in the chest, and one in the back. The weapon used is believed to be a .357 caliber revolver. The male victim had been referred to as Jock, which means that he may have originated from the French name Jacques, indications that he may have been from French Canada. A man who claimed he'd met the victims earlier in the week stated that the victim had stated that he had left the Canadian family with his girlfriend. It was further stated that his father was a well-known doctor. This theory is supported by some of the items that were found on the bodies. However, no one has been able to identify these two parties. What we do know is that the early morning hours of August 9th, 1976, the young man and young woman were said to have been seen from a distance by a man. It was said that they had been dropped off on Locklear Road, a secluded dirt road between I-95 and South Carolina Road 341. It's possible that the victims may have had their vehicle hijacked, possibly by hitchhikers. Then upon exiting the vehicle, someone may have shot them both in the back. Now at 6:20 a.m., a trucker named Martin Durant found the bodies and contacted Charles Graham, an employee at the nearby store. Graham, in turn, contacted the police. Now, you have to remember, this was 1976. People didn't have cell phones at that time. The male victim is believed to be between 18 and 22 years of age, but the age range has been updated between 18 and 30 years after this case had further investigation regarding DNA work. The police believe that a unique type of root canal surgery that had been performed during this man's life could be important for discovering who the victim was. It looked as though he had been midway through a complete dental restoration. The man had a 4-inch appendectomy scar. He also had various scars on his back and shoulders, which indicated frequent participation in contact sports, is what the police believe. He was wearing faded Levi brand jeans and a red t-shirt. The t-shirt read Coors, like the beer, the American Light beer, on the front, and a Camel Challenger GT Sebring 75 on the back, along with a Snoopy design. The shirt was apparently a promotional item from the Sebring races held in Sebring, Florida in 1975, which were reportedly sponsored by the Coors Brewing Company. This gentleman had on no underwear and carried a pack of Grant's truck stop matches in his pocket. The matches are believed to come from Grant's truck stop somewhere in the Midwest. He also wore a gold Bulova wristwatch and a Twisto Flex band bearing the serial number H918 8803. The investigators were able to determine that the Bulova watch was made in 1966, but when the company downsized in the early 70s, they destroyed many of the records, meaning that there's no way to ascertain where the victim's watch was distributed or bought. He also had on a 14-karat gold ring with a gray star sapphire stone. The initials JPF were engraved inside the ring, which had a Florentine finish. Both the ring and the watch appear to be rather expensive. This, together with the man's elaborate dental work, suggests that he had come from an affluent family. Now, the female victim was slightly younger than the man, and she was originally thought to be between ages 18 and 20. However, they believe now that's between 18 and 25. She stood 5 feet 5 inches tall, weighed 100 to 105 pounds, and had a slim build and an olive complexion like that of her companion. There's some speculation that perhaps they were actually siblings. The female had reddish brown hair, shoulder length, and bluish gray eyes, some would refer to as hazel. She also had 2 distinctive moles on the left side of her face near her mouth. She was wearing a white, unbleached blouse over a pink type halter top, and she also had on some cutoff jeans, obviously referred to as Daisy Dukes. She had a floral print scarf tied around her waist as a belt, and she wore a Stride Rite brand wedge heel sandals that were lavender and pink in color. And she had 3 distinctive rings. The first ring was a black oblong stone that appeared to be a small turquoise chip embedded in it. The second was an ornate scrolling feather shaped with coral and turquoise stones. And the third was a simple metal band with red, white, and blue stones. These rings appeared to be authentic handmade Native American or Mexican costume jewelry, and they were all made of sterling silver. The police believe that the jewelry originated in the southwestern United States. And like the man, the female also wore no underwear. Now, in 1977, a man in South Carolina was arrested for driving while intoxicated. He owned a revolver found in the vehicle of the same kind as the murder weapon. It was proven to be the murder weapon after it was test fired by investigators. The man located was not charged because they believed that there was insufficient evidence to file charges against this individual for the murders. The book of matches found in the man's pocket provided further clues to the police. The matches came from a truck stop chain, which had locations in Idaho, Nebraska, and Arizona. And after information was released to the public, a man from Nebraska stated that he may have performed a repair on the car with Oregon or Washington license plates whose owners matched the description of the victims. But this uncovered no additional leads for investigators. Some believe that the serial killer, Henry Lee Lucas, could have been involved in the murders. Lucas himself told the police that he had been in South Carolina the day that the victims died, but he was received with skepticism as he had a penchant for false confessions. He was never charged with the crime, and he died in 2001 as a result of heart failure. Mr. Lucas had confessed to 2 murders that also happened in Sumner County, but those were for an elderly woman in 1975 and a young man in 1983. Now, in 2007, both bodies were exhumed and obtained DNA information. This led to the theory that the pair maybe were siblings being disproved. The testing showed that they were not genetically related, though they did resemble each other. If anyone has any information about this case so as to provide an identification of these individuals, which could potentially lead to charges being filed, they should contact the Sumner County Sheriff's Office and ask for Investigator Charles Bonner. His phone number is 803-436-2000. Someone, somewhere, has information that could lead to the identification and hopefully the arrest of whomever committed both of these murders. Next on the docket, our dumb criminal contestant of the day. He comes from Pennsylvania, Nicholas M. Mark. That's right, he was arrested after he stole the tip jar from the pizza joint that he was applying to work. Now the 22-year-old is facing felony counts of robbery and misdemeanor counts of theft, simple assault, weapon possession, and drug paraphernalia. The pizza store employees were under the impression that Mr. Mark was looking for employment when he came into the shop to fill out an application. However, they quickly realized his intentions were much more devious when he allegedly grabbed a tip jar off the countertop and fled. The jar had roughly $220 in it. An employee ran after Mr. Mark, but the chase ended after Mr. Mark pulled a knife. When the police ultimately arrived, they found a backpack containing the items with Mark's name on it, as well as razor blades and multiple syringes. Authorities also had Mr. Mark's application to work with, which included his home address and his cell phone number. After looking up his name, the police were able to search records and find his home address, where he was ultimately arrested. Mr. Mark, first of all, sounds like you have some drug issues that you need to deal with. But as we've talked about all the time here on Crime Talk, one of the most important things that the government always has to prove in a criminal case is identification. Now, when you steal something, but they know your name because they filled out a job application, they're gonna be able to find you, which clearly shows your brilliant plan of stealing the tip jar in open public and giving your name to the potential employers clearly shows that you are either really dumb or you have a lot of drug and alcohol issues that you need to deal with. It could just be a combination of both. Now, you, Mr. Mark, are our dumb criminal contestant of the day. That puts you in contention to be the dumb criminal contestant of the week. If you are crowned the dumb criminal contestant of the week, I will locate you through a search database, just like the police did, and I will send you a Crime Talk mug. Now, for all of you who want Crime Talk merchandise, but don't want to become a dumb criminal contestant, simply hit the link below to Teespring and get your Crime Talk merchandise. There's some cool new stuff up there. That's all we have for you today. Hope you enjoyed it. Have a great day.